From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. Russian President Vladimir Putin held court today in Moscow for 3.5 hours at his annual year-end press conference.
Today, we are stronger than any potential aggressor. I repeat, any aggressor.
That recording from CNN, Putin also criticized Democrats in the U.S. who he said are, quote, losing on every front and looking for people to blame everywhere. He praised Donald Trump, saying he understood the mood of the American people and kept going when nobody believed in him, except for you and me. That last line, a quote, reportedly delivered with a grin. Yuri Vendik is with the BBC Russian service. He joins us now. And Yuri, do you think that Putin was getting a little satisfaction poking at those in the U.S. who say that he and Russian hackers interfered in the American election?
Well, yes, by the expression of his face, you can tell that, first of all, he likes the fact that Donald Trump has won. Now, he also said that Ronald Reagan would be very glad that his party is winning on all fronts. And yes, he said that Donald Trump fought till the end, although nobody, I quote Putin, except you and me, except us, believed he would win. And he was also asked about his probable meeting with Donald Trump and his future relationship with the new U.S. president. Putin said that it's difficult to say at the moment when he's going to meet Donald Trump because Trump has to form his team first. And, of course, the question he's going to discuss with Trump is the question of normalization, as he said, of the relationship between Russia and the United States.
Well, that reference to Ronald Reagan rolling over in his grave, of course, was a reference to President Obama saying that he would roll over in his grave because so many Republicans in the United States have a favorable view of Vladimir Putin. But let's go a little bit more deeply into what Putin said about how he foresees working with Donald Trump once he's in the White House. It sounds like he's very open to it.
Well, he's open at the moment. It seems that the Russian administration and Vladimir Putin in person, they genuinely believe that Donald Trump is going to deliver on his promises, or at least on his tweets and some statements about the relationship with Russia, and the relationship will improve. But at the same time, they are pretty cautious, and Vladimir Putin is also pretty cautious about that, about what will actually happen when Donald Trump moves into the White House. So there is no much to say. You know, the format of this big press conference, they happen every year. This is an annual event. I've been to many of them. The format of press conference allows Vladimir Putin not to elaborate on themes he doesn't want and to elude the answers to difficult questions. So, and it goes not only for the relationship with the United States, but for many other themes that he's been asked.
Yeah. Well, in this country, as you know, Donald Trump caused some alarm when he said yesterday that he wanted to strengthen U.S. nuclear forces. I understand Putin said what? That it didn't bother him that Trump had said that.
Yeah. First of all, the Wall Street Journal asked about the nuclear weapons. He said that Russia successfully modernizes its nuclear weapons, both warheads and missiles and other carriers, as far as I understood his speech. And he also said that he's surprised by the fact that some of the American officials now start insisting on reinstating that the U.S. Army is the strongest in the world. He says nobody argues that. But at the same time, the Russian army is stronger than any potential aggressor against Russia.
Right. So he's boasting about Russia's military strength and also saying that it wasn't Russia that's to blame for speeding up an arms race. What do you read into that?
Well, yes, to be exact, he said that the United States initiated the arms race, or if I quote Putin exactly, he said the United States have created the prerequisites for the armed race when they quit the AMD treaty.
You're referring there to the anti-ballistic missile treaty. The U.S. has withdrawn itself from it, which allows missile buildup in Eastern Europe, which Putin is concerned about.
Yes, exactly. And so Putin said that the other party, as he said, meaning Russia, is compelled to respond.
Putin also spent some time talking about how Russia's economy is improving. And I wonder, is he putting a rosy picture on the situation there, or are Western sanctions not working the way they were intended after all?
Yes, some economists, Russian economists, who are critics of Mr. Putin, yes, they say that this just sounds weird. Russia's economy is not thriving, to put it mildly. Again, this format, you know, Putin says something, he throws in some figures that the economy is growing, the agriculture is growing, the economy is being modernized and so on, but then, again, nobody can challenge him in this format of the press conference. And unfortunately and regrettingly, in very many cases, journalists, colleagues just do not pick up others' questions. And they never say, sorry, I've got my own question, but it seems to me you didn't answer the previous one. They never do that, regrettingly.
Yuri Vendik of the BBC Russian Service, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, about that talk of a new arms race, President-elect Trump doubled down today, reportedly telling MSNBC, quote, "Let it be an arms race because we will outmatch them at every pass and outlast them all." On NBC's Today Show, Trump's incoming press secretary, Sean Spicer, was asked to explain that remark by host Matt Lauer.
If there's going to be an arms race,
there's not going to be.
That's what he says.
But here's
my point. We will match them at every turn.
But there's not going to be, because he's going to ensure that other countries get the message that he's not going to sit back and allow that. And what's going to happen is they will come to their senses and we will all be just fine.
This all goes back to
The comments by Trump and Putin over the last 24 hours have alarmed many nuclear arms proliferation experts. But our next guest is for now watching and waiting. Gary Seymour is executive director for research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He also led the American group that negotiated the latest arms agreement with Russia, the New START Treaty, which went into effect 5 years ago. And I asked him for his reaction to Trump's words.
Well, I don't take it very seriously until we see how his actual policies come out. We've reached the point where the main systems we use to deliver nuclear weapons, bombers and missiles and submarines, are going to be reaching the end of their life cycle over the next 10 to 15 years. So we're going to be spending as much as $1 trillion to modernize those forces. And any president would have to do that. So we've got to wait and see exactly how Trump translates his tweets into real policy before we can make any judgments.
Well, regarding the New START Treaty, which you negotiated with Russia, I'm seeing that there were key targets, reduction targets, that both the U.S. and Russia have to meet by 2018. Are the nations on track for that?
Yes. The New START Treaty sets a cap of 1,550 deployed strategic warheads for both sides. And the U.S. military is very confident that 1,550 nuclear weapons are more than enough for nuclear deterrence. And the Russians are also satisfied with that level. So I would be very surprised if either the U.S. and Russia would want to exceed that limit. What's going to happen instead is replacing older bombers with new bombers, older subs with new subs, older missiles with new missiles. The Russians have been doing this for a long time, and now we're going to be entering a cycle where we'll have to do it over the next 10 to 15 years.
Well, I'm seeing that the BBC is reporting that President Vladimir Putin there was talking about carefully monitoring changes in, quote, the balance of power and political military situation, especially along Russian borders. Could he have possibly been referring to U.S. missile defenses in Eastern Europe?
The Russians are very concerned about U.S. missile defenses, not only in Europe, but also our national missile defense system. The Russians, I think it's very alarmist, but the Russians calculate that if the U.S. launched a first strike, we would destroy the vast majority of Russian nuclear forces, and whatever limited forces were left wouldn't be able to penetrate U.S. missile defenses. I can't imagine any president taking a risk like that, but when the Russians do their worst-case assessment, it makes them very nervous, and that's why they've been investing a lot of money in modernizing their nuclear forces to make them much less vulnerable to a U.S. first strike.
You know, one of the things that President-elect Trump said during the campaign as a candidate, he said a lot of contradictory things about nuclear proliferation. You know, one is that he does believe, he said it several times, that it's one of the biggest challenges and threats the world faces. He said that. But then also in March of this year, a couple of times, he said he wasn't so sure if proliferation was a bad thing, if Saudi Arabia or South Korea or Japan, built up a nuclear arsenal. Later in March, he told CNN that proliferation is going to happen anyway. It's only a question of time. So, you know, I take your point that it's hard to imagine a U.S. president, you know, doing what you had hinted earlier, but how are we to interpret the talk that we've been hearing both earlier this year and now from the man who's to be the president of the United States and from President Putin, just the very way they're talking about nuclear weapons?
Well, I think we've learned not to take President-elect Trump's campaign statements very seriously. They're not a clearly well thought out set of viewpoints. So I think we've got to wait and see how his actual policies are carried out. And it will be some time, I think, before that becomes apparent.
Well, Gary Seymour is the Executive Director for Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He also led the American interagency group that negotiated the New START Treaty with Russia back in 2010. That treaty went into effect in 2011. Gary Seymour, thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Magnus. Happy to do it.
The World Health Organization says a new vaccine for the deadly Ebola virus could be ready within a year's time. The temporary vaccine has not yet been approved by any regulatory authority, but an emergency stockpile of 300,000 doses has already been created. It is a significant leap 2 years after the Ebola outbreak that claimed 11,000 lives. Anthony Fauci with the National Institutes of Health spoke with NPR today and said this about his confidence in the vaccine.
The study itself was relatively small when you think in terms of the numbers of people you generally do in a big, massive vaccination trial. And that's the reason why vaccine trials are still going on to determine if we can get a better immune response. But we feel reasonably confident in the results of this particular trial.
The announcement was just one of many science stories to catch our attention in 2016. There was also Zika and the efforts to get that virus under control. And there were significant steps forward in DNA science and artificial intelligence. Mariette DeCristina is editor-in-chief of Scientific American, and she's here with her top stories of the year. Mariette, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me today.
Sure. I understand that right at the top of your list is the discovery of gravitational waves.
Oh, what a real favorite this one is for me, I have to say personally. 100 years ago, when Einstein published his theory of relativity, who knew how many ways that this would affect our lives? And here's one that, for me at least, solved a great mystery and for thousands of scientists as well.
Okay, you've got to explain it a little bit because this is complicated, but basically it's direct evidence that black holes exist, right?
Yeah, let me back up and explain a little bit about relativity. So just imagine a piece of fabric, like a blanket, and imagine that you grab one end of it and gave it a wiggle, and you'd see a little ripple go across. That's what happens when two large black holes collide with each other. They have literally disturbed an area of space and caused ripples, which we call gravity waves.
Hmm. Going back to high school physics right now, although I'm not sure we ever got there. Maybe it's college, advanced college physics.
It might have been a little bit more towards college, yeah.
Well,
but what's cool about this is these two black holes collided with each other a billion years ago. And last year, the couple of detectors that we have here in the U.S. in Louisiana and Washington State kind of heard the chime of that little wrinkle that we were just talking about.
Fascinating. Well, okay, let's talk about Zika, arguably one of the biggest stories of the year overall. As we know, brain defect-causing virus spread by mosquitoes throughout the tropics and even now in parts of the United States. Here was Centers for Disease Control Director Tom Frieden in May.
We have never before identified a situation where a mosquito bite could result in an infection that causes a devastating birth defect. It is unprecedented, it is tragic, and it is now proven.
Frieden says unprecedented. How important was this as a science story?
Well, I think it was a huge science story for all of us. I mean, starting off maybe when a lot of us in the U.S. at least became aware in February when the World Health Organization declared a public health emergency about this out of Brazil. And as he just said, we had never seen before a mosquito transmission lead to these kinds of birth defects, which led to smaller heads and smaller brains in little babies when they were newborns, but also can cause an autoimmune disease that can affect people of any age.
Yeah.
For a time there, we weren't even sure if it was the Zika virus or something else, which was part of the cause of the emergency.
Well, there's still a lot we don't know about Zika, actually. The World Health Organization says that the public health emergency is over, but there's still a lot of research going on trying to figure out some of the details of this virus.
Yeah, that's totally true. There are several studies that we'll get a better picture on that were happening this year, and we'll see the reports next year. But on the hopeful side, as you say, the WHO has declared the end of the public health emergency. And one of the reasons is we now can focus on sort of positive aspects, so learning more about it, like you've just mentioned, but also vaccines that could be used. And we'll be heading soon in the coming months to human trials. There are at least two of them that I'm aware of that are coming along. So hopefully soon we'll start to see some ways we can address this problem.
Well, this next story is fascinating. Okay, so a patient in China this year became the first person to be treated with gene-edited cells. Now, if I'm remembering correctly, that's CRISPR, right?
Yeah.
What happened?
Very good.
Yeah.
It's called CRISPR and CRISPR-Cas9, and I'm going to do us all a favor and not give you the acronym spelling. But basically, all you need to know is what CRISPR comes from is a bacterial defense in our own bodies that uses an enzyme called Cas that cuts DNA apart, and it's a way that we fight against things. And so they've used this this technique of the enzyme cutting to try to, in the case of this patient that you're mentioning, who has lung cancer, stimulate the immune system so that the patient's own body can help fight against the cancer.
And there's a lawsuit now involved with CRISPR.
Oh, yeah. Boy, this is a big one. That's actually been going on for a while. So two research teams at different institutions both came up with a technique and both filed for patents at pretty close to each other. And there's some dispute for various reasons about who might actually be first. So the U.S. Patent Trade Office is doing what's called a patent interference, where they're trying to determine which team was actually first to use the technique, not just file for the patent, and also which one had the idea to do it first.
And another problem with that, I mean, some people are saying, look, you could use this to create designer babies, which would be a little bit scary. You pick the qualities that you want to have in an embryo, for example, which could be scary. But let's go to a different story. There is this AlphaGo computer program that was created by Google that used artificial intelligence to beat a world master at the ancient Chinese game of Go. So here, let's hear a little bit from Demis Hassabis, who helped create AlphaGo. He's going to explain how his program learned to play.
It starts off by looking at professional games and learning from those. Then it learns by self-play through practice, if you like. And then it learns to do planning on top of that.
Okay, why did AlphaGo make the list?
What a cool innovation this was. It's in something called deep learning. And what this does is try to use human neural networks, meaning the way our brains think, as a model for the way computers can think. And to play the game of Go, it's got pretty simple rules, but it's complicated for a machine to play because on this 19 by 19 size grid, there are, in a typical game, more options than there are atoms in the universe. So for, you know, one thing computers are great at is crunching things really quickly, but you can't crunch through, you know, more options than atoms in the universe if you do it the kind of straightforward blunt force way that computers normally would work.
Hmm.
So what's amazing about this is that it could play a human and beat a human in a paper published by Nature in January of this year.
Wow.
where they revealed the results, which is kind of amazing.
Yeah. Number five on your list is climate change. And, of course, this was the year that the Paris Climate Accord was signed. It's a major victory for climate activists. On the other hand, Donald Trump wins the White House and promises to roll back environmental regulations. He's nominated a climate change denier to lead the EPA. And also just major problems in the Arctic this year. The ice is melting because temperatures are so much higher than normal.
Right. I mean, just on the sea ice piece, there's no doubt about it. In the past several decades, we've seen increase in warming by every metric that we can see, or climate change, I should call it, actually, because although it's a global, you know, warming overall, climate may be warmer or cooler in locations, which I think often confuses people. So every time there's a cold snap from something like the polar vortex, which everybody was talking about recently, people will say, well, does that mean climate change has gone away? Well, no, it hasn't.
It's actually a symptom of climate change, right?
It actually is. So you got that quite right. So a bit of a seesaw year here where we had a lot of early in the year, you know, with the Paris, agreement that you mentioned looking very positive, including in September when the U.S. and China, you know, which together account for 38% of the emissions, said they would come aboard and other nations came aboard. But immediately, unfortunately, we're hearing some signs or a lot of signs, I should say, given both the language used and the appointments proposed that the president-elect may decide to pull out of the Paris Agreement. And he's in the past even called climate change a hoax by the Chinese.
Hmm. Okay, here's the last one we're going to talk about. It was a very big moment that sounded like this.
So you're seeing live footage of course I still love you, our drone ship, waiting for the... There's the engine. Slow it down, lights up deployed.
That was people so excited about the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, which was landing. A reusable rocket on a robotic drone. It was the private space company's fifth attempt to do it. How important was this to you?
It was a beautiful landing. I actually was just watching that video again this morning myself.
Did you get excited again?
And I did, actually. You know, I have to say, hearing the sound is just as good. It seems such excitement in the air. But what an amazing feat to land something kind of exactly where we wanted to. I mean, the saying that, you know, it's not rocket science, or it is rocket science, is because it's so hard to do. So this was kind of tremendous engineering and science compared, and who knows where humanity will head next with
it. Yeah. What's it mean for space?
I think it means potentially for space the kind of dream we've all dreamed of, which is, could we reuse the space equipment the way we have said we would? I mean, the shuttle, U.S. shuttle, famously was supposed to be going all the time to space. It turned out more complicated than that. It turned out a lot more expensive than that. Those missions used to cost $500 million each. Maybe someday it will be easier, and then maybe we can extend our human reach to places like Mars, which I know is on the docket, and other beyond.
Maria DeCristina, editor-in-chief of Scientific American, with a look back at the year in science. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
And yes, we know it was a busy year. We did not get to everything. There was that baby born with DNA from three parents. That was interesting. And the Greenland shark named the longest living vertebrate. It gets to be 500 years old. That's crazy. Tell us your top story at hereandnow.org.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping you make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from a community of artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get three meals free with free shipping at Blue Apron. blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
The culinary world is filled with unusual delicacies. Think haggis from Scotland, bird's nest soup from China, and Rocky Mountain oysters from the American West. Luke Runyon of Here and Now contributor Harvest Public Media summoned the courage to try them recently and has our story.
I pride myself in having an iron stomach, but I've never felt more hesitation for the food in front of me than at this moment.
Okay. Standing in front of a plate of fried testicles.
I'm at Bruce's Bar in Severance, Colorado, looking for any excuse to not eat this basket of battered, deep-fried beef, lamb, and bison testicles. You might know them by their nicknames: lamb fries, Montana tenders, or my personal favorite, cowboy caviar. Here at Bruce's, they're Rocky Mountain oysters. And before we get to my first bite, let me explain how I got here.
Okay, so we're in Severance now. That orange building on the corner is Bruce's.
I moved to Colorado from Illinois in 2011. Tried some new foods, like elk and yak. But still, I felt like I was missing out on something. I needed some Colorado cred. And the Rocky Mountain oyster was my last hill to climb. I settled on Bruce's because it is the center of the Rocky Mountain oyster universe. The tradition is baked into the town of Severance. Take the sign on the way in.
Welcome to the town of Severance, where the geese fly and the bulls cry.
The outside of Bruce's is painted with cartoon bulls with their legs crossed. There's one riding a motorcycle holding a sign that says, "Still got mine."
Hey, Dennis. Must be Luke.
Yes.
Dennis, nice to meet you.
How's it going?
And you couldn't ask for a better expert than Dennis Guffey. He's been in charge of the kitchen at Bruce's for more than 40 years.
I don't know if you've ever eaten Rocky Mountain oysters before.
This actually will be my first time today.
I think you'll like it. Just don't think of what you're eating when you eat it, okay?
easier said than done, Dennis. He says a lot of people have a hard time taking the first bite. I ask why.
I really don't know. I think some people are just funny about the food they eat.
Like many things with Wild West origins, there's a rich tapestry of Western lore built around Rocky Mountain oysters. There are old tales of cowboys holding big parties to fry up the testicles. Dennis says he hears customers say they're an aphrodisiac. After slicing, dicing, breading, and deep frying, Dennis brings out the basket with a side of cocktail sauce.
So you guys want to sit down and have a little bite?
And now, the moment of truth.
I'm a little nervous, actually.
Ah, they're good.
Okay. Standing in front of a plate of fried testicles.
I go with the more exotic bison oyster as my first taste.
Oh my god.
There's no good way to say this, but they were surprisingly juicy. And I know this is cliche, but the bison tasted like chicken. Dennis asks how I feel.
Now I can, like, stake a flag and say, I've had Rocky Mountain oysters. I am more of a Coloradan today than I was yesterday.
There you go.
For Here and Now, I'm Luke Runyon, reporting from Severance, Colorado.
Severance. Luke's story comes to us from Harvest Public Media, a reporting project that focuses on farm and food issues.
It's time for the annual Christmas edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
There goes the last DJ.
We're going to listen back to a conversation that Jeremy had last year with his favorite childhood DJ, Mike Hale. He's general manager at WHMS in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois.
I got to tell you, I'm gratified every time I get a chance to be on your program because I get dozens of former people from Champaign, Urbana, former U of I students who moved away a long time ago, who will email me or check me out on Facebook and go, oh, you're still living in Champaign?
Well, see, I remember you, of course, because I used to listen every year when you would pull it together, all the songs, all the Christmas songs that you like to listen to and do a big Christmas special on the radio. And I would record it on cassette tape and then listen over and over again.
Well,
I think I still have that tape somewhere. I'm going to have to go find it for next year's edition of the DJ Sessions.
Okay.
But you know, I will say one of the nice things about having you on is with all of the things that are going on in the world, it is nice to just sit back and listen to some of these songs.
Absolutely.
Well, let's get to some of the ones you have brought with you today. This is the 1967 hit Snoopy's Christmas by the Royal Guardsmen.
The Baron had Snoopy dead in his sights. He reached for the trigger to pull it up tight. Why he didn't shoot well, we'll never know. Or was it the bells from the village below? Christmas bells, those Christmas bells, ringing through the land, bringing peace to all the world and goodwill to man.
So tell us about this song. Why is Snoopy going to war here?
Well, first of all, this is a group called the Royal Guardsmen, and they were a group that was an American group that wanted to, you know, have a British feel about them. And this was their follow-up record to the first song they had, which was Snoopy and the Red Baron. And Charles Schulz gave them blessing for doing this, got his permission, and it is really a cute, cute song.
That's interesting. Charles Schulz, the guy behind Peanuts, enjoyed the fact that Snoopy became... Well, and I guess if you watch the new Peanuts movie, he does get in a Red Baron.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, let's get to a classic here. This has got a... With a bit of a more modern twist. This is Baby, It's Cold Outside. And it's sung here by Dean Martin with Martina McBride.
I really can't stay.
Baby, it's cold outside.
I gotta go
but
away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you drop
so
in.
Very nice.
I'll hold your hands that just like
my
ice.
Mother will start to
beautiful worry. What's your hurry?
And father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace
so
roar.
Really I'd better scurry.
Beautiful, please don't
or
hurry.
Maybe just a half a drink more.
Put some records on while I
the neighbors might
baby it's bad.
So in this song Martina McBride is actually dubbed over Dean Martin there.
Yeah, this was a Dean Martin recording from 1959 from his album Winter Romance. And they've done this with Frank Sinatra, a number of artists that have passed away. And it just puts brand new life into Dean Martin. I mean, it's an incredible recording.
Well, it's interesting because these days when you hear that song, it could very well be the very popular version by Michael Bublé.
Or it could be Rod Stewart and Dolly Parton. Mm. There have been so many great versions of that particular song. And Martina McBride was what I thought was an unlikely pairing with Dean Martin. But there's just a magic. It sounds like they're actually in the studio together.
It does. Well, let's get to another one. This is All I Want for Christmas Is You. This is the 1989 version from Vince Vance and the Valiants. So, Mike, who are Vince Vance and the Valiants?
Well, they're a country group from the East Coast. This is not to be confused with Mariah Carey's All I Want
right.
for Christmas.
Well, that's the one everyone knows, right.
And this was just a cool little recording. In fact, I think I heard it on WIL in St. Louis. I was driving through St. Louis, and I heard it, and I said, wow, this is great. So I went back to the radio station. We found a copy of it, and it's just a neat little song.
Well, our next one is one that I remember you playing back. It's probably there on my cassette tape somewhere. This is Feliz Navidad, very famous song, released in 1970 by Jose Feliciano, the Puerto Rican singer-songwriter. Here it is.
Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Feliz Navidad. Prospero año y felicidad. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas.
Mike, why is this song so popular in a way that songs in Spanish often are not in the U.S.?
You know, I think it's because the tempo of the song, I think you always have a smile on your face when you're listening to this particular song. And come to think of it, I don't think I've listened to any remake of this song, because this is a song that cannot be remade by anybody else.
Why is that?
Maybe it's because Jose wrote the song and you can just feel that he loves this particular song.
I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas. I want to wish you a Merry Christmas from the bottom of my heart. I want to wish you a Merry.
So what's the Hale family Christmas like?
The Hale family Christmas is really special. Because, and I attribute it to my father. When I was 2 years old, my father said, our family will wake up on Christmas morning together. So we would not go visit any relatives. Every relative was welcome in our house on Christmas. But my father insisted that we would all wake up together on Christmas morning. And I instilled that in our family. My daughter Jennifer, son Christopher, and my wife Linda and I would all wake up together on Christmas morning and see what Santa did.
Of course, Christmas can also be a very difficult time for people, especially if they've had, you know, difficult things happen in the family in the previous year. Did you have any of those moments throughout your life that maybe Christmas helped you get through?
Absolutely. My mother loved Christmas, and she gave me the appreciation for Christmas music. And my mother died 3 weeks before Christmas in 1990. And it was her thought. And the whole time I was playing music around Christmas in 1990, there were so many songs I was thinking about my mother. Happiest Christmas Tree by Nat King Cole, a number of songs. And that brought a smile to my face. So Christmas music really helped me get through when my mother passed away.
With a hey and a he and a ho ho, with a he and a ho and a ha ha, with a ho and a ha and a he he, ho.
I'm the happiest Christmas tree, ho ho ho, he he he. Someone came and they found me and took me home with them.
Oh, I'm the happiest Christmas tree, ho ho ho, he he he. Look how pretty they dress me. Oh, lucky.
Well, Mike in the Morning from WHMS in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, my hometown. Mike Hale is his real name. It's great to have you with us on this Christmas Eve, sharing some of your Christmas playlist. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Jeremy, for having me.
Look how pretty they dress.
And that conversation was recorded last year. You're listening to Here and Now.
Little lights that tingle whenever anyone passes by. I blink my lights and I wink my eye. Oh, I'm the happiest Christmas tree. Christmas Day.
Wind energy is still relatively new in this country, but the industry already sees a big problem ahead. A single wind turbine blade is 170 feet long and weighs 22,000 pounds. There are three blades on every turbine. So how do you deal with that when a wind farm reaches the end of its life? Carl England is a professor at Washington State University's Voiland College of Engineering and Architecture. He's looking for ways to recycle these blades to keep them out of the landfill. He's on a Skype line. Professor England, welcome.
Well, thank you.
Wind farms are supposed to be environmentally friendly. For the most part, they are. But this landfill issue could be a big problem as more projects around the country are aged out and they're decommissioned, which I understand is already happening.
Yeah, it's starting to happen. You know, if you look at the onset of the wind industry and the larger wind turbines that you see out there throughout Texas, Oklahoma, you know, central Washington, wherever you may be, California, a lot of those started 2005, 2007 range. And the average lifespan of a blade roughly is about 18 years. So we're going to start seeing some of the first generation blades coming offline. We're actually already seeing them coming offline. And so they're becoming a bit of a problem for wind farm managers to deal with.
What makes them so hard to get rid of? Is it more than just the sheer size of them?
The sheer size is definitely one of the big problems. You know, you got 175, 180 foot blades. They're trying to make them even longer now. And so they are big, they're massive, they're voluminous. You know, if you cut them down, then you also have to do the same transportation logistics as you did to bring them to the site. And so you get a lot of costs that are associated with that. Then you get the tipping fees at the landfill. And so those can be quite prohibitive in some cases. And then there's landfills that are already starting to, in the States, say that, no, we're not going to take these things. And pretty much all throughout Europe, they're not allowing you to put these things into landfills. So,
well, there are projections by European researchers, and Europeans have been thinking about this a little bit longer than Americans have been because the European market is that much more mature. But those researchers say that by 2034, the industry will be producing 200,000 tons of blade waste globally every single year. And where you are in Washington, you're actually trying to lighten the load. What are you doing?
Yeah, so, you know, we look at, you know, if someone gives you lemons, you make lemonade out of it. And so we look at that and say, wow, that's a lot of feedstock that we can use for a new product. And we've developed a process that we can make a composite panel out of these composites that can give some really nice properties that are better than traditional wood composites that are out there right now.
So what are you saying? Are you saying that you take these fiberglass blades and you bust them up into tiny pieces and make something new out of them?
Yeah, that's exactly. It's kind of like that. It's similar to that. There's a little more detail to it than that. But most of these blades, one of the real nice things about these blades is they are a mix of glass fiber and wood. So that really kind of helps us out, primarily breaking it down and then keep a very nice, clean, consistent feedstock for your secondary operation.
Well, what kind of products are those turning into, those new panels?
Oh, we're hoping that, you know, the auto industry would look at these things. The flooring industry is another market that could very easily go into these things. In any area where you're dealing with potential fire issues that you would use wood composites for, that you want to, you know, beef that up a little bit more. You know, most of your wood composite panels that you put into water, they swell, they crack, they break down. You know, since this is made up of quite a bit of glass fiber in there, we don't have that kind of problem. And the same thing with fire retardancy. We can get, you know, a class A fire rating in some of the cases with these products. And so that's our process right now. We're working with design engineers on developing a plant design, how we put this all together. And then once we get that going in another year or two, we'll be producing these panels.
Well, the Europeans, I've mentioned they've been facing this problem a little bit longer than we have here in the United States. They've come up with some ideas to take these blades down, use them as sculpture, as public art at bus stops and as benches and that sort of thing. Do you see that catching on in the United States, and is it even really effective?
Well, you know, those are always fun, and they're cool, and I think it gets the mindset of people going, yeah, we can take things and we can recycle them. But that's it's a very, very low volume that you're dealing with. I think what a lot of Europe is potentially doing with these things is grinding them up similar to what we're doing, but then just throwing it into concrete as a very low value fill.
Is that effective?
The artistics, yeah, it is. I mean, it works. We want to step away from it being a recycled product and look at it as a value add product that is made out of recycled materials.
Hmm. Carl England is a professor with the Voiland College of Engineering and Architecture at Washington State University there in Pullman, Washington. Professor England, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, Peter.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.